This is an interview with Dr. Henry Pitot at the top of McArdle Laboratory. Today is September 9th, 2013. I'm Molly Loss. So, Dr. Pitot, you first came to McArdle as a postdoc in 1959. So why did you decide to come here?
Well, let me go back a little bit. I got my bachelor's degree in chemistry at the University or at Virginia Military Institute. And at going there, I thought I wanted to go in the service as a career, and that sort of cured me. But I did major in chemistry, and the organic chemistry professor there required that all students do research and write a thesis or something like that for graduation. So that was my introduction to research. It was synthetic organic chemistry. But that gave me an interest in biochemistry, which I knew nothing about at the time. I wanted to learn biochemistry, and I was told that in order to do so, you had to go to medical school. You couldn't, there wasn't enough. That wasn't really true, but the people I talked to said that. So I did go to medical school at Tulane University. The reason for that is that my family, a lot of them, live in New Orleans, and so I could live with relatives. It was cheaper that way. And my father didn't object to the cost of the university itself, which really wasn't that bad at that time. But that continued because during my first year, I almost quit because it was so rote and it wasn't anything I was used to. But I met an individual, Dr. Emmanuel Farber, and he's a pathologist, and I worked in his laboratory, and he allowed me to do that at part-time during class or during the school year. But that didn't introduce me to McArdle. It continued to introduce me to research and medical research. But in the summers, between my first and second year, I worked with an individual by the name of Dr. Ernest Kuhn, K-U-N, who I think is still alive. He was at the University of California. But at that time, he was at Tulane as a visiting professor. And I spent the summer doing research with him in his laboratory. He was working on amoeba. And in addition, there was another individual there who was a synthetic organic chemist by the name of Joe Deschary, D-E-C-H-A-R-Y. He worked for the government, actually, but he did some part-time work. Between the two of them, I got very interested in medical research. And sort of discussed things with them and suggested that, you know, there were some, I'd like to work on how disease mechanisms work. So Dr. Kuhn indicated to me that at the University of Wisconsin there was a laboratory called the McArdle Laboratory, which had to do just with cancer. So that was my introduction really to the lab, was his discussion of it. And when I went back in my sophomore year and was working again part-time in Dr. Farber's laboratory, he knew of this, and we discussed it as well. And his interest was liver cancer, and that got me interested in that. So again, I had talked to him about quitting and going to some place where I could get a good basis in chemistry, and he said, well, you're already in second year of medical school. It'd be a shame to waste all that. Why not use it, get your MD, and then train in biochemistry, which is what you were interested in. And at the same time, we could arrange to have you train in mechanisms of disease, which is called pathology. So that sounded like a good thing to do, not thinking farther than the end of the table as to how this is going to work. And I kept working in his laboratory for my junior, for my sophomore year. Junior year was pretty well clinically involved, but I still managed to sneak out here and there and get in the lab. And during the summers, I worked in his lab. Well, during my sophomore year, I met my, actually during my freshman year, I met my future wife. And we went together until and got married between my junior and senior year. And again, I wasn't thinking very farther in the future. I was just knew that what I wanted to do. And in talking with Dr. Farber, he said, well, why don't you apply for a fellowship? And then this will support you and your wife and whatever children might show up during this time. Well, at that time, fellowships were the ones that were used mainly by people in the life sciences. One of the major people, one of the major places that you got them was the American Cancer Society. And I forget, they had a name, and I can't remember the name of it at that time. That was in the 40s, 50s. But at any rate, it was a national thing. You had to compete. And I was very fortunate and able to get one of those. It paid $300 a month. And if you had dependents, I think it added $100 a month for a dependent, something like that, up to a certain amount. At any rate, this was supported by the American Cancer Society, so I've always been sort of beholden to them because after I graduated, I went right into pathology. I didn't do an internship, which everybody looked at me and said, you're nuts. But I certainly wasn't the only one in the country. A lot of people did this sort of thing. And I went right into the specialty, and at the same time to graduate school there at Tulane. And since they didn't have a large number of biochemical courses, I took chemistry courses, and a number of them in physical chemistry and organic chemistry, advanced organic chemistry. But then I also took what they did have in biochemistry. And the two together, together with Dr. Farber, who is a terrific mentor, worked out pretty well, so that by 1959, I was able to get my doctorate in biochemistry, complete my requirements for pathology, and was ready to leave. But that's getting a little ahead of the game, because still talking with Dr. Farber, I told him I was interested in going to the University of Wisconsin to find out more about this McArdle laboratory. I wrote to Dr. Rush, actually, in my junior year and asked him if they had graduate programs and things of that sort. And he wrote back to me and told me the programs that they had. So I became very interested in Dr. Potter's work, because he was at the moment working on liver, just like I was. And so it sort of fit pretty well with things. And at the American Cancer Society meetings in I think it was in 59, actually, I met him. The way I did it was I sort of met him in the elevator, told him who I was and what my interest is, and he says, well, why don't we go and have a cup of coffee? And at that time, I had just about finished my dissertation, so I had a lot of things that I could talk about. And he became very interested in what we were doing. So he said, why don't you write to me, and I'll see what we can arrange, you know, for maybe if you want to work as a postdoc. So I said, that was great, and I did that. And he accepted me as a postdoctoral fellow. And the fellowship that I had one more year. And so it allowed me, at that time, we had four children and one on the way. And so we were getting the maximal amount that they would allow, and I think that was $6,500 a year. So we came here and rented an apartment. They were actually nice duplex apartments out on Brody Drive, which is far out University Avenue by Spring Harbor. And I was worked in the lab, Dr. Potter's lab, and my wife took care of the kids, which was a major operation. And we stayed here, and the research got very interesting. At that time, there was sort of a mini breakthrough that there were certain types of transplantable cancers that became available. And we started studying. We were one of the first laboratories that started studying them. And that led me into a whole series of things in studying liver cancer. And Dr. Potter became interested enough, and I guess he talked to Dr. Rush or something, that ultimately they offered me a faculty position. I had been offered a position at the University of Southern California, and of course Tulane wanted me to come back. Actually, I went. There was a fellowship. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was something which supported faculty, young faculty, and you had to go to an interview with all of the potential people who had been applied to. Each university was allowed to present one candidate. So Tulane presented me, and I, at that time, thought, well, that'd be great, you know, if it would happen. Well, I had a rather harrowing experience, which I didn't really realize. It was in outside of Williamsburg, Virginia. And so I flew from here to Washington, and then there was a flight from Washington to Norfolk, which is very close by. Well, I was on that flight. We went down there, and the weather was very bad. It was one of these British jets, which looks like a DC-9. I forget what they call it. And so they turned around and came back to Washington, and they said, well, you can wait until the weather breaks, or you can take a bus. So I said, well, that weather's not going to break, so I'll take the bus. Well, the plane went back and crashed. All people were killed on the plane. So my wife didn't know anything about it, but all of the neighbors did. And she got up with one of the kids, and she noticed that all the lights were on in the neighbor's house. And so I called her up after that. I found out what had happened because my father called me. He was living in New York at the time. He knew about this too, so he managed to get in touch with me and said, are you okay? I said, sure, what's going on? I didn't know anything about the crash or anything like that. And so he told me, so I immediately called up Julie and told her. But that was, you know, just on the side. But the interesting of that, I don't know whether it had to do with that or anything, I was the most outspoken individual in those interviews of the whole thing, and I'm never like that. That's entirely opposite to my personality, and I was not chosen, and it turned out that was probably the best thing for me, because Tulane did not offer me a position, and as I said, University of Southern California did, and then Dr. Rush and Dr. Potter and I don't know who else got involved. But they did here, so we took it. And it was sort of an offer you couldn't refuse. Although it was interesting because the salary that I was given, which is $9,000 a year as an assistant professor, after taxes, was less take-home money than I got as a postdoctoral fellow. So we started off... fairly you know, poor as far as that goes, but then things over the years have changed. So that's how I got to McArdle. And I had a number of chances to leave, a number of offers that were given, and including Yale. I stayed here.
Why didn't you take those offers?
Well, none of them, with a large family, it's kind of difficult to move. That's the one thing. But the other thing is, the only one I became interested in was interesting was Stanford. But they never offered me a position. And I'm sure the reason was because I had a large family. And but all of the others, the trips were great. And I think I went to, I don't know, 15 or more campuses in the country. But none of them really had what I had here. And even though the salaries were, some of them, three or four times what it was here. But again, in, for example, Tulane offered us a position, and the salary is very good for there. But when we, my wife figured it out, to go down there and put the kids, you had to put them in private school. By the time you finished that, we wouldn't have any money to eat on. So it really, in many cases, it wasn't. On the other hand, the University of Rochester, there, one of the big things was all of your children went to college free. That would have been an enormous, you know, thing. But it just, I never did.
So when you first arrived here, what was your lab like? What were the facilities like?
Well, the lab and office together were about half again as big as this room. And they were really carved out of Dr. Potter's place. He was nice enough to do that. And we still collaborated very intensely. It, some of my research began to go off on a tangent, but for the first 3 or 4 years or more, we were pretty well collaborators, close collaborators. And then, of course, when we moved into the new building, I had a separate place, so it was different then, because we started in several other areas of research which were different from his. But that really didn't make any difference. I mean, the camaraderie and the association and the opportunities for students and fellows here were just enormous. And nothing really ever was able to compare with it.
So what was it like to work with Van Potter?
It was really a tremendous experience, because one thing about Van was he was very, the word democratic is not the proper word, but it certainly is that he gives complete the ownership of something to the individual who does it. And there are a lot of major professors that don't do that. And he taught me that fairness, which is really a tremendous gift. And he was extreme. He was almost like a father to me, certainly a scientific father. And I remember he gave a seminar at one time. He was talking about some of his work on the nucleotide metabolism. And he had trained with a fellow in Sweden, wasn't it? Do you remember? Whose name I can't remember. Who in turn had trained with one of the pioneer German biochemists. So he said, I can trace my scientific ancestry back to such and such a person. And that impressed me. So I said, well, you know me, I can trace my scientific ancestry back to him. Of course, that wasn't really true, because there it branched off, because Dr. Farber was a major factor in my upbringing. And the fellow that at Virginia Military Institute, Herbert Ritchie, was, I think, very important too. He really got me interested in research, because I had absolutely no idea of anything like that before then. And I was gung-ho on going into the military.
So how did your relationship with Potter evolve over time?
How did what?
Is your relationship with Potter, how did it evolve over time?
Well, I think in many respects we became closer. In other respects we became a little more distant because our research separated. When we were doing basically, both of us were doing liver cancer research. We were very close. And, you know, we kept, Van had research group meetings, and I would meet with them all the time. And when I became an assistant professor, I had, and he really got this, there was a fellow from a graduate student, I've forgotten where Carl came from, Carl Pereno was his name, and he came here as a postdoctoral fellow. He was sort of joint between Van and myself, but he was the first postdoc that I ever had. And then the first graduate student, which really Van sort of shifted to me. I think she would have worked with him if I weren't there. Dr. Cho, Yunsang Cho, she was a Korean person who had her MD, and she was working for a doctorate. And she was a very hard-working, sharp young woman who unfortunately had a tragic accident a few years ago and was killed at the National Cancer Institute. But so from that standpoint, I think the initial association was very, very close. And the only reason it sort of drifted apart, and it really didn't drift apart because I still looked up to him as, you know, sort of a father figure, was because we were physically separated. And my group got bigger. When Dr. Rush negotiated with the NCI a program project grant, and each person, I did get my own grant before that, but then when the program project grant melded all the grants together, then Dr. Rush really partitioned the money out as he figured was the appropriate thing. And he was good to me. It allowed me to expand research program and up to a point where it was really too big. But then it whittled down after that. But so I've had a number of postdocs and graduate students over the years. But Dr. Potter and I have always, or Van, I should say, has always been very close. And even his, where we did separate a little bit, this is on spiritual matters. I'm a devout Roman Catholic. And he is, I guess, an agnostic. And we've had several discussions of things like that. None of them, you know, emotional or anything like that, just very straightforward. But he knew my situation, I knew his. And then he got into bioethics, which is really a, you know, it is, it's a practical spirituality, you might say. And I supported him in that completely. I didn't read as much of his material in that I should have. Basically, I didn't have time. But I would learn directly from him as to what was going on. And,
Did you find you agreed with some of his ideas about bioethics?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there's no question. Nobody could disagree, I think, unless you're such ungreen as you could be.
So, can we, if we can shift a little bit to talk about more of your colleagues, I'd like to know what Harold Rush was like as a director.
Well, Harold, again, was a person who, he was director, and his function was to make sure that all of the faculty did the best they could. He would try to get money for them, he would try to make things good for them. For example, in the old building where I had that little lab, we were really squeezed, and he was the one that got us out of that, basically. He had political connections, and he was the one that got this building built, got the money for it. His dream was ultimately the cancer center, which he did reach it, but then unfortunately he didn't stick around. He was unable to see it, you know, realize what it is today. But I'm not sure he would agree with this move out to the center. My guess is he really would. But from what I understand, the space is going to be kind of squeezed out there. So it'd be quite a different operation than we have here.
Mm-hmm.
But Harold was unique in that position. He was a very humble man. And he just gave everybody the potential to be the best they could, and that was his function, which is not the function of many chairmen of departments that I know of, but in his case it was, and that was, I'd say that's one of the big things that kept this, made this place what it is, and hopefully chairmen that have been in that position since then it's only been three of us, have kept that same philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I tried to, certainly, and I think Norman did as well. I don't know, Jim, I don't... Unfortunately, the department's gotten so big now, it's much more bulky and unwieldy as it was with Harold. Harold had some good points, which have changed, and I think, as an old fogey, is that my feeling is not for the better of the department. For example, I was allowed to have a joint appointment, and there was a good reason for it, because I was a board certified pathologist. I became certified during my first year as a faculty member here, passed the exam, and then I. So that was a joint appointment, and I did teaching in pathology, and I did service work and everything, but it didn't interfere with my research. My laboratory was here, everything. Now I think it's a little different. We have a number of joint appoint faculty members who come to faculty meetings, but for the most part you don't see them at any other time. And it's not really the same thing to have that input into the department at a very personal level. When you had everybody working in the same building together and you'd see everybody and they'd meet. And the meetings were, I won't say social, they were social, but they got pretty knocked down, drag out. And everybody was very, there were no secrets among anybody. It was, you said your mind, and that was it. And Harold managed to maintain things very well under those conditions. But again, at that time, the faculty, I think there were nine or ten, something like that, when I started. When I started, Howard Temin started at the same time, and so did Dr. Zabolski, Vaslav.
Mm-hmm.
But and they had full labs, although Howard, I think, with that lab he started out with, was not, he was in the basement, and they had floods down there, and the poor guy was trying to do tissue culture. It wasn't the best of operations, but Howard kept up with it. I think he probably saw the advantage of McArdle and the way it worked and the way Harold worked.
Can you say a little more about that? What do you mean? So you're saying that he could see the advantage of McArdle for the way he worked.
Well, the way Harold, as I've been saying, he tries to get everybody what they need to do their research. Mm-hmm. And he certainly did with Howard, but the problem was the university. I mean, you couldn't get things to work and to get going and cleaned up and everything the way it should be. It was supposed to have been done before he ever came here. But I know those days, and even the days when I was acting dean, to get somebody here at the university to do something within a reasonable period of time, that's like getting water out of a rock. I mean, it was just impossible. For one thing, because the people who were doing it, there weren't that many of them, and they were overworked. Everybody wanted something done because the buildings were getting older, and they had to have things done to them. And in the case of the basement, particularly if you're doing cell culture, there was a lot of work that had to be done down there to make it so that he could do his cell culture. So that I think for a number of months, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, he literally could not do any research down there. They just had to try to clean the place up and get it as ready for them. Then the workers came in, and of course they did what they were doing, made new floors, I guess, and put in new walls in certain areas, things like that, and that dirtied up things all over again. So it was very frustrating, I think, for Howard for at least the first 6 months or more he was here. But then things settled down, and he had a good operation down there. It worked very well. And Harold, just to give you an example, I mean, here's a man who, talking about Howard now, who was doing research in an area which was fairly brand new. It was the RNA tumor viruses. And he had gotten his degree and worked with the people out at Caltech who were the really pioneers in this area. So he was one of the young people who were trained by these people. Plus, Howard was an extremely brilliant guy to begin with. But he had some ideas that he worked on, and he really followed them. But for several years, he had no publications, virtually none. And in fact, I became an associate professor, as I recall, a year before Howard did. And part of the reason was he just didn't have the publications. But Dr. Rush still bet on it. And he stood by him, and as you know, that really paid off. So that's sort of what I meant.
So can I ask you about the third member of your, I guess, 1960 cohort? What was it like to work with Vaclav Sibalski?
The who?
What was it like to work with Vaclav Sibalski?
Well, I really didn't work with Vaclav. I work with one of his people. Whose name I can't remember. He was a visiting professor here working with Vaclav. And he was an expert in cell culture. Now, I was interested in cell culture, but obviously didn't have, in this little laboratory that I had, we couldn't do any cell culture. But this fellow would sort of, we could collaborate a little bit, even though he was working with Vaclav. And he would come to Dr. Potter's group meetings, and we discussed technologies in cell culture and things of that sort. So that I'd say, was my closest association with Vaclav. In the years since then, his expertise in molecular biology is something that you can certainly try to interact with and get information from, some of the technologies that he has. And he helped our group several times, some of his people, in working on certain technologies. But I was never, let's say, very conversant with Václav. On the other hand, with Howard, I was. It became more so as he went on in his work. And I think that, you know, for a while it was a big splash around here. I remember when I was young, where liver cancer was a big deal. I mean, the Millers were working on it sort of tangentially, and we were working on it, Dr. Potter and myself, and I don't know, I guess Charlie wasn't, but at any rate, it was really the thing that everybody became very interested in. And so Howard, what he was doing wasn't really considered that, you know, significant. But then he came out with a couple of papers, and it sort of showed, there were sort of seminal papers that I think people have forgotten a lot about the metabolism of Rous sarcoma-infected cells and things of that sort. And they sort of have formed the basis, actually, of some things. And then, of course, he came out with his RNA-directed DNA synthesis and the reverse transcriptase. And that that had been, I mean, he had presented that at a meeting. It was at least a year before the discovery. And I think he was laughed off the stage, basically. But he was convinced that's the only way the virus could replicate. It had to have that. And so he, with his postdoc, Mizutani, were able to do this. At the same time, of course, Baltimore, I think really, I don't know, but my guess is that he listened to Howard and said, maybe he's right. And so they parallel did the same experiments, or comparable experiments. And, so it was really interesting to see Howard's advance. And he got the Nobel Prize when I was director. And I remember he called me up, or it was early in the morning, I think it was about 7:30 in the morning, and said what had happened. And I said, well, that's absolutely phenomenal, you know. And we had a party, I think, up on the 11th floor or something for him that day.
Go ahead.
Well, the other people that, you know, at that time, I guess the closest people that I had worked with were Jim and Betty Miller. And part of the reason for that was that I was a pathologist. So I could read their slides. They wanted, you know, the histology of all these things that they were producing with the various materials they did. And they, previous to that, had sent these to the State Laboratory of Hygiene, which is a building over here, if it hasn't moved yet. It's supposed to move, I think. But at any rate, they could send their slides over there, and after about 3 or 4 months, they'd get them read. And I think there was a fellow in pathology who occasionally would read some slides for him. So it was a very hit-or-miss operation. So for them, it was very nice to have someone who could read the slides. And, of course, that required that we develop a histotechnology laboratory. Well, I was very fortunate, and I cannot remember the circumstances in which this happened. I think it was some friend of mine in Chicago who told me about this fellow that was a technician of a pathologist by the name of Otto Saphir, who was a famous pathologist at the University of Chicago. And this fellow had come to Madison. He was looking for a job. So I talked to Dr. Rush and told him, you know, this would be, because before that we had to have the slides made over at State Lab. And again, one that was expensive, and the other thing was that it took more time than you'd like. So actually we got in touch with him. I don't remember the particulars of it, but we hired him. His name is George Pridmore. He was an older individual, but he could cut and stain slides like no one I've ever seen. Of course, he was trained by a master. Saphir was one of his things, was histotechnology. But George was with us for a number of years. And even later on, we convinced Dr. Rush to get an electron microscope. And George was really the person who maintained the thing, kept it going, until we got Carol Sattler, who was technically an expert. But George did quite well.
So about when was this? What years?
Oh, boy. George must have come here around 65, something like that, plus or minus a year. It was when we were in this building. It wasn't in the old lab. And he had one module up on the sixth floor, which is actually in Charlie Heidelberger's research space. But we had carved that out, and that's where he did the histology. And so that's how I got together with Jim and Betty. And then over the years, of course, it evolved into things. We did some collaborative work. They would stick my name on papers that really, the pathologists, they can have an enormous vitae, and all it is they read the slides for this, that, and the other. They didn't know anything else about the research. But fortunately, I was able to, with them, discuss the research with them. So I knew most of what was going on. And I think we even contributed some biochemical measurements in some of their studies. But that continued. And I got to know both of them pretty well. And of course, when I came director, then I asked Betty if she would be the associate director. She was a very, very interesting person. She was very humble like Harold, but at the same time, she was an extremely exact scientist. She, the graduate students and postdocs that worked with her, that was one thing they knew about her. They had to do the right thing. And when they take measurements, do experiments, they do it right. And if they don't, they'll hear about it. Plus, Betty was also, you see, in the building. Actually, when I came here, the journal Cancer Research, which is one of the major, it was for a long time the major English journal in English about cancer. And it was put out by the American Association for Cancer Research, which is the group that, the experimental group at that time. And still is, for that matter. But, and it was on almost newspaper-type paper. Very rarely did they have pictures. You had to pay for the pictures. So most people didn't have the money to pay for them, but they would have some. And the editorial, Harold was the editor, and Ilse was the, what would you call her, the managing it or whatever, that type of thing. And she really did the, checked all the manuscripts and everything. And I didn't get to know Ilse at that time that well. Later on I did. But that stayed here for, 10 or 15 years. I don't know when it left. I can't remember. Maybe when Harold gave up the directorship. I think probably at the same time that he figured he couldn't do all that. So, but that was something that Betty was, she was a member, I think, of that group, wasn't she? Do you remember Betty? I think so. She was on the editorial board. And so therefore she had an extremely good knowledge of you know, publishing, and her papers were just perfect, you know, in any English and everything else, grammar, and so forth. And but she had been, I guess I would say, maligned when she was training. She came here, and I've forgotten, I don't think she got her undergraduate degree here. She came here to get a graduate degree. And she ended up in home economics, the reason being that they didn't have, the biochemistry department, rather, was just taking male students. And she even, they had a fellowship program. And she applied for it, and she was either the top or the second from the top in the thing, but she didn't get the fellowship. And the reason simply was because she was female. And that, I mean, she could have become very bitter as a result of that. She never did. She just continued working, and actually what happened was she ended up by a back door getting a major professor in the biochemistry department, so that she ended up with a degree in biochemistry. And and I think too, she was an associate professor. I don't know how long she was an assistant professor. She was an associate professor until, my gosh, the late 60s, which was absurd because she had published very seminal work much earlier than that. And of course, she married her husband. I think they weren't graduate students, but I think they were just finished. And they worked together as a beautiful team. They had two girls, two who were still alive. Isn't that right? Yeah, they're around. But Jim was a little more staid than Betty, at least as far as I was concerned. But he was a very, very good person, and he had many of the characteristics of Betty. But Betty was, I mean, we would do was get together before a staff meeting every time, and we'd discuss the. So every week, we had about an hour, we'd sit down and discuss the department and what things are going on. Betty certainly had her ear to the grindstone much more than I did. Unfortunately, I became involved in some national things and whatnot, which kept me away from the lab. But Betty didn't do that much traveling. She stuck around here, and so it worked out extremely well. It was one of the saddest things I ever seen when the diagnosis of her malignancy was made. The pathologist, I knew what the prognosis was. I couldn't discuss it with her, but she was optimistic up until, I think, the last couple of months. And then she sort of realized the situation. But she's a great woman.
Can I guess, ask you about your relationship with Roswell Putwell?
Well, let's put it together with Roz and Jerry. Roz and Jerry were very close. And I'm not so sure they supported, one, my being made as an assistant professor, because they figured this guy is an outsider, he's too young, what do we know about him, it's, you know. So I tried to be as sociable as I could with him. And Roz and I have become, I think, reasonably close. Jerry and I became very close after he retired. I used to visit him at his home. He was in congestive heart failure for much of the last few years of his life. But he was a very good person. He was brimming over with ideas. He had all kinds of ideas about this, that, and the other thing, and most of which he couldn't follow up. But the ones that he did worked out fairly well. He did some work that really portended the whole estrogen receptor thing. But unfortunately, he didn't really get into the see it through as some other people did, and they got the credit for it. Jerry was well known in the endocrine field, but I think he should have been better well known, at least given some credit for things which developed in that. But both of them, we used to go to meetings, and I would room with them. They would always room together, and then they'd put a cot in the room for me. And it was kind of amusing, as they were great roommates, actually. So I think that, over the years it became, I think even when I became director, I went around and talked to every faculty member before I accepted the position. I wanted to see everybody's, what they thought. Of course, in those days it was a vote type thing, and which was meaningful. But in talking with Jerry and Roz, I remember with Jerry in particular, it was a little bit of hesitancy. But with Roz, I don't think so. Roz was more of a laid-back fellow. He had his own ideas about research, there's no question about that. But we became much closer because later on in our research, it led us into a multi-stage mechanism in liver, which was quite analogous to what Roz had been studying for years in the skin. So we had many discussions on that. That happened probably, I'm just trying to think when that was. That was in the 70s. I don't remember exactly what, I think in the middle 70s or something like that. So it's really been an evolution with those two. I think it started off a little questionable. I was sort of considered an outsider by them. And it just slowly warmed and worked into a very great relationship.
So you did work more closely with Charles Heidelberger, right?
No, I worked closely with Van. I did some work with Charlie.
Yeah.
The first one, which was basically at one of these staff meetings, I gave a talk, which was sort of a journal club, and there was an article that had come out about this new concept of the feedback mechanisms for gene expression that Jacob and Monod, two Frenchmen, had come up with. And I was just sort of armchair doing this at the blackboard and, saying, well, you could make up something with cancer and do the same sort of thing. And Charlie said, well, why don't we publish this? I thought, well, it's really, I don't know what you would get out of it. Well, it's amazing. We we published a paper together in which we sort of used the Jacob Monod concept and applied it to malignancy. It was purely theoretical, that no basis in experimentation or anything. But that paper was, my gosh, we got reprint requests going, I think, for more than a year, year and a half. And I don't know why it became so, you know, popular. But I think it was just a way that people in cancer research could connect with people that had been working in bacterial genetics for so long. And bacterial genetics was really just exploding. And in this way, you could say maybe apply some of this to the cancer field. But it, you know, as with many things, it just sort of disappeared. But it was really kind of funny because that's the way it started out. So actually, outside of that, my association with Charlie, I don't know, I probably read some slides for him, but I can't think of anything else that we really interacted with. He was involved in skin cancer. And then, of course, in chemotherapy and various drugs that we use. But I think that was all. Yeah. Socially, of course, Charlie was a very sociable person. He and his wife, his first wife, were very wonderful people. They had a great family. Yeah.
So can we talk a bit about support staff? I'd like to ask you about...
About what?
Support staff. I'd like to ask you about Helen Iverson.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, the hero, as far as I'm concerned, there are two of them. It's Helen Iverson and Ilse Rigo. And Helen... I just became associated with or got to know, obviously, because as a faculty member, I'd come up there and ask her how things were and so forth, and I tried to be as sociable as I could. So I really liked her. I thought she was a great, great lady. And then when I became director, we got somewhat closer with respect to what was going on in the lab, and she would obviously have to know about budgets and things like that. And Helen was the expert in this. How she kept things going with, I think she only had one or two assistants. Probably one assistant, one student or something like that. And the budget was getting bigger and bigger. I mean, every year I think, when I became director, the program project grant was over $1 million. So that was to keep all that, you know, going together. But she was a very nice person. She was a bowler. She actually, I think she and her husband owned a bowling alley, as I recall. And she got Julie and I, my wife, interested in bowling. So we'd go into her place and we'd bowl a few frames. And then we'd sit and chat, you know, when she was there. So we got to know her, you know, on a social level in addition. But she was just a wonderful person in the lab. She managed to keep all of the faculty reasonably happy. And to do that with 9 or 10 prima donnas scientists, that's really an amazing feat, but she did it pretty well. And again, you know, like Betty, Helen developed ovarian cancer. And I'll never forget the day she came into my office up on the 10th floor, and she said, "I'm a statistic." And it really didn't hit me what that meant until later. But she told me the situation when she was operated on. Basically, it had already spread quite a bit. And in those days, chemotherapy wasn't to the level it is now, particularly the support. Helen would take these drugs. I don't think she was taking platinum, but I've forgotten what she took. But it would just, wipe her out. She was sick for 4 or 5 days after they'd give this stuff. And she'd come back to the lab after a week or so and spend a week or two at the lab, and then she'd get another shot of this stuff. It was just very sad to see that, because she was at the same time obviously losing weight, going downhill. And she lived in a very beautiful home on Lake Monona. And I remember going over there after that, and she asked me a question which I really couldn't answer. She asked me, what is it like to die? Because she thought as a physician I should know. Unfortunately, pathologists are after the fact. But so she was a great person, and Ilse was, I got to know her when in this building very much, because for one thing, she helped me tremendously with manuscripts, as Betty has done too. But I would come up and kibitz with her just like graduate students and fellows. She was great in her office. She'd talk to anybody at any time. And she was a unique individual. She had a doctorate. I'm not sure it was in biochemistry or
zoology.
It was in zoology. But she knew a good bit of biochemistry, and she knew a reasonable bit about oncology too, particularly after being in the journal so much. But she kept the reading room, which I guess is going to disappear, and would help faculty members with manuscripts. And she and Betty basically wrote the major grants for this department. We'd all contribute, but then they would put it together and make it a readable and presentable sort of thing. And I've heard, in those years, from several people at the National Cancer Institute how detailed and excellent these grants were. I mean, they did get grants from some people which the grammar was a mess. But these grants were just perfect. The two of them, with their editorial abilities and everything, plus their knowledge of the field, put those two things together, were just an unbeatable situation. So actually, when I was director, I was really blessed with an amazing team of Betty and Ilse and Helen. And I just traveled a lot.
Well, great. Well, thank you. That's all my questions for today.
Okay.